potassium permanganate.
Okay, potassium permanganate. You know, I am not a good with remembering all these chemical expressions and so on. So I have to look it up each time. And these two liquids were injected into the decomposer, and when they met the hydrogen peroxide, it decomposed. Mm-hmm. And later on, it was found if you used platinum deposits on solid ceramic material, that did the same trick, and you could do away with these additional containers. You know, it simplified everything, and that is what Rockdyne did on the redstone. They had a solid catalyst for the decomposition. For the decomposition of hydrogen peroxide. And then in the Jupiter, I remember, I mentioned this only because these were all the predecessors of the cell.
Yeah.
We were interested in the historical development. Then one used the actual propellants, kerosene, RP1, and oxygen. And you had an extra star tank on the ground. You started everything up, you know, on the ground, and then you had to disconnect when the missile took off.
Mm.
That was one way, and the Air Force used onboard containers, star tanks.
Mm-hmm.
Star tanks, a little liquid oxygen container and a kerosene container. And you had a gas generator, and then you started your turbine, and as soon as your turbine had spun up your pumps, you had the full pressure, and then you tapped it off from whatever. And then the next step was the H1 engine. The H1 engine didn't have these start tanks anymore, neither on the ground nor on board. And then the gas generator was fed from the tank. Now how was this now? You had a solid turbine starter. Are you familiar with this?
Solid turbine starter?
A solid propellant.
John is.
A solid propellant turbine starter. It burned roughly 3/4 of a second.
Mm-hmm.
3/4 of a second. It was roughly this size.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a special solid propellant which produced no combustion gas temperature higher than around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And since it was short, you know, your materials, the walls and so on, could absorb enough heat not to overheat it.
Mm.
And with this initial energy, you cranked up your turbine and the pumps, and then you got, increasing pressures. You tapped off and fed them into a gas generator. A gas generator is a combustion device,
mm-hmm.
which burns a fuel-rich mixture. You have oxygen,
mm-hmm.
and you have a mixture ratio of roughly, I guess, 0.8 or what it was, I don't know. It is definitely fuel-rich, I would have to look it up. The proper mixture ratio for oxygen and kerosene was around 0.3. That was the mixture ratio in the main chamber. And in your gas generator, you have, of course, a much smaller mixture ratio to keep your temperature at around 1500 degrees Fahrenheit. That's what we had. And the materials at that time were already available to stand 1500 degrees Fahrenheit. And your solid propellant starter, they call it Spitz, solid propellant turbine starter, Spitz. That was inactive, and so if you would put on two and protect it by a membrane or diaphragm, you could have even had a restart if necessary, but that was not required. Okay, on the H1 engine. Then came the J2 engine. In the J2 engine, the solid propellant gas generator and the solid propellant turbine starter was too heavy. The same was true for the F1 engine. So you had to do something different. And initially, it was considered to use a tank energy. You know, You have, you can pressurize both your propellant tanks,
and
then feed tank head start, feed this into your gas generator and so on, but it took too much time at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so this concept was dropped, and then the start tank, which contained high pressure helium at first, and then high pressure hydrogen
mm-hmm.
at 3000 PSI or
something like that.
But if you have a gas at this high pressure, you have to watch your temperatures. If they are too cold, you do not have enough energy to get the whole system up. And if it is, if the temperature is too high, then you might not have enough energy either. So this start tank required very careful conditioning. And all this conditioning business, you know, which is many times overlooked and which is so essential, especially if you are in orbit, that is included in our responsibility. So it is not only the mechanical hardware, it is not only the rocket engine. What we did also the whole conditioning, and the heat protection, all the thermal engineering and environmental control, and this is all this whole area was handled. You asked me in the beginning what was our involvement and our responsibility. So I would like to point this out.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, these things are normally not properly appreciated, but if they are not taken care of carefully, they can ruin the whole system, or your whole vehicle, or your whole stage, or this and so forth. And they are not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have found out, that the temperature control is actually one of the very essential aspects everywhere nowadays. If you in rocketry, or in spacecraft, or in life support equipment, or in cameras, or in a lunar rover, then you cannot neglect the temperature control. If your batteries are too low or too high, you're out of business. And so we have, on time, we have built up a considerable capability in thermal engineering, as we call it, or thermal analysis. And without a computer, we couldn't do it.
The computer?
Without a computer, we couldn't do it. And we have sometimes to run thermal condition requires 12 hours on these most advanced computers we have today. It's terrible, it's terrible.
Where did you really begin to use the computer methods? When the Redstone and the Jupiter?
No. I can tell you exactly. You know, when the Jupiter had to be developed, we ran into the re-entry heating problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the second imaginary horribles. The first one was, one of the very first one imaginary horrible was the sound barrier, you know. As a famous designer as Heinker, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I see in front of my eyes an article he wrote. He gave a lecture somewhere, you know, the big, who made these fast fighter planes in Germany, you know, Heinker.
Yeah.
Heinker, he was famous. And even this man said, the speed of sound is a barrier we cannot overcome. He was thinking about propeller planes, of course.
From this point of view,
he was right. You know.
There was
a competent man can have the wrong outlook, or he can underestimate a certain development. It was one of these imaginary horribles, a sound barrier.
When you remember the date?
Oh, that was in early in the war.
But Messerschmitt was already developing.
Yeah,
in 1962.
That's right, but you know, to develop something and to believe in it and to trust in it is something different. Anyhow, I have read with my own eyes, and I see today, because it really shocked me, you know. in engineering, you have to be extremely careful. Never use a superlative or whatever it is, you know, because what is justified as a superlative in the morning might not be justified by noon, and even less the next day. But he was a man. I can tell you something else. And then the next imaginary horrible was a heat barrier. And of course we were very fortunate here because we developed the ablative protection. You remember this. And I was heavily involved in this. And at first I took my slide rules and made all these numerical calculations. It made you crazy. And you just cannot do it. I mean, it wears you out. And but I had enough experience with the redstone, you know. We ran into one problem with the redstone, which was not considered before. Our LOX tank was aerodynamically heated, and even during ascent, and it started cavitation of our pump. I remember the third flight of the redstone showed an unencountered anomaly.
Mm.
And then we analyzed it, and we found out it was because the oxygen pump ran into cavitation. And you know, during ascent, the oxygen container was heated.
Mm-hmm.
And the light stuff collects like the grease spots in your soup, you know, on the top. And all this hot stuff is like in a centrifuge, you know, it is the same thing, because your heavy stuff goes down to the bottom and the light stuff goes up to the liquid gas interface. And then at the end, the pump has to digest or to ingest all this hot stuff, and that's where the pump started to stutter and didn't do it. And then we analyzed it, and we could prove that the temperature increased by five degrees centigrade, and it was much too much. We ran into cavitation, and then that caused the introduction of the inducer. You know this? You know what an inducer is? To feed into the main impeller at a certain head or pressure, the liquid. That was it with the redstone. And then with the redstone, of course, we had to do a lot of aerodynamic heating and so forth. But for a simple trajectory at lower Mach numbers and short duration, that was not difficult. And came the re-entry heating for the Jupiter at Mach number. What was the re-entry Mach number? I guess it was six or seven. And everything has two sides. We had on the redstone, no, on the V2, we had a jet vane made out of graphite.
Yeah.
And then it was good for 60 seconds without excessive erosion. And then in White Sands in New Mexico, for some reason, they wanted to increase the flight, the performance, use bigger tanks. And this meant an extension of the burn time of these V2 rocket engines. And one thing that did not stand up, the 90 seconds, it was a jet vane. It eroded too much, and then it did not provide the control effectivity it should. And so this prompted a search for improved materials, and the first attempt was to get improved graphite, but there was nothing available. And only after, I guess, several years, one company was able to come up with an improved graphite. And during this time, we were looking into all sorts of materials for the replacement of the graphite. And we hit fiberglass, plastic reinforced fiberglass. And then we came to this re-entry business. We said, this re-entry heating is roughly, for the intermediate ballistic missile, was roughly the heat transfer you could get in a rocket chamber. And that if this material was good for the rocket exhaust, why shouldn't it be good for re-entry? But he did not know. And so you asked when we used the first computers. And at first we tried to do this by hand. It was impossible. And then we got, fortunately at this time, we got our first electronic computer. What was the first one, 650 or what? A very primitive engine by present standards. And many people were very reluctant to use it.
Was this 57, 58?
It was 56, yeah, 56. 55, 56, mm-hmm. 57. I still have these original calculations. And there was one man, that was Emil Braunlich. He was an applied mathematician, and he helped me a great deal.
Uh-huh.
And, then we had the problem to solve a melting layer. Normally, if you have a heat transfer problem, your surface is constant.
Mm-hmm.
But now, all of a sudden, the problem was to consider a melting surface, you know, melting surface.
Mm-hmm.
And we modeled this, and then we took also into account the thermal properties changing with temperature. You know, these initial more simplistic and primitive analyses did not go into all this trouble. And then by using difference methods, you know, we wrote up our computer programs on this simple machine, and we compared different materials. And at the same time, we put them into our rocket engine.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to test hundreds of materials, you know, and with such a regularity that you could set your wristwatch according to the test noise you heard, you know. We had used from the Hermes project, out of the General Electric Hermes project, we had used a 20,000 pound rocket engine. It used kerosene and oxygen, and we used, in addition, for ignition, we used hydrogen peroxide. And it was a very reliable rocket engine. Each time, you know, it was started, it burned, which was, of course, at that time, a phenomenal rarity, because all these rocket engines, they never worked at the times they should work. We had it really in our backyard. And then came the aerodynamicists, you know, all these smart guys. And they proved 100,000 times how wrong we were, because we could not, for this and that reason, we could not simulate re-entry conditions, and we would all be wrong, and so forth, and so forth. Terrible. And we did not get influenced by all these wrong claims. We did our work, and we had plenty of experience and data already under our belt, and you can see it in the Space Orientation Center, you know, on one of these walls, all these
cones.
And our analysis showed that actually a superior material would have been a ceramic material, and we let a contract for drawable magnesium oxide,
mm.
this Battelle Memorial
in
Columbus, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it looked extremely fine, but once in a while we got these cracks, and we did not dare to have cracks. Maybe it wouldn't even have hurt. And it, As a parallel approach, we used this fiber-reinforced plastic, glass fiber-reinforced plastic. And we had plenty of these sheets available, and we put them together on a turning lathe, and, you know, we turned it into the shape and put it into our rocket chamber.
Mm-hmm.
It stood up extremely well, extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
And then we found out that the orientation of the fibers was important. The fibers perpendicular to the surface, they would hold much better than if you had some parallel. Yeah.
Mm.
And then we used Teflon, and what all the materials you could think of. We used balsa wood and soaked it in water. It worked fine too.
Mm.
But how do you handle balsa wood? You know, the connections and so on. There's nothing compared to the fiber reinforced plastic, which you can weave and cast and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Then, after we had established the principle, we didn't do the manufacturing. We got to an expert who really knew how to handle all these things. Okay. You said when we first used computers for thermal, that was during the development of the ablative re-entry nose cone protection.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, at this time the Air Force had a different concept. They wanted to maintain with a super quality, smooth copper cone, laminar flow. And
they are dynamicists again?
Yeah, they're aerodynamicists. You know, aerodynamicists are in the business to make a lot of wind and air. Doesn't have to have anything behind it. That is their business. And they fought us, and they ridiculed us, and we were so wrong, but we were not influenced by this. And Dr. von Braun said, okay, now we have to prove it. And if we tell them that we have a solution, no one will believe us. They always will fight us. And out of this consideration, it was decided to develop at the same time a recovery system. And then they said, oh, look at these crazy guys. It is easier to find a needle in a haystack than to recover a nose cone of this size from the Atlantic Ocean. And they knew that this would never work. And you know what happened? The first recovery attempt was successful, and President Eisenhower showed it on TV to the whole nation. And now it's in the Smithsonian Museum. That's the first nose cone. And that's where we made extreme advantageous use of our, at that time, very primitive computers. But without them, we couldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. And this really set us up in the business. Thermal engineering, thermal analysis. And it came in so handy when we had the first cluster, because there was no precedent. But, oh, I have to tell you something else. After the small one, which was fired on a, what was it, on a Juno 3, that was a three-stage redstone, and then a solid propulsion, and a second or a third stage. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with these configurations?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that was only a sample or a model. And then we had to fire a full scale. For this, we needed a Jupiter. And this was recovered too. And I think one sample is still in our Space Orientation Center, and the other one is in Washington, the Smithsonian Museum. Mm-hmm. So this set us up in the thermal engineering. And then after, in 58 or 59, the Jupiter program was canceled, and only the Thor was acknowledged. Mm-hmm. You remember this? There was always a heavy controversy between Army and Air Force. Mm-hmm. And now they sent inspectors down, snoopers, who had to check that we did not work on this re-entry protection or nose cone protection. Run secretly additional tests and so on. They checked several times and people down to make sure that we did not work in this area. And then came the Saturn program. Cluster, you know. Only by next Christmas, I guess it's what one of the senators said, run a cluster test and show that engines can be clustered. Fine, I mean, this was done. And then after this was successful, okay, couldn't you build at least a stage, a clustered stage? Oh, why not? And then came the problem of the base heat protection. And of course, having worked for 3 years almost on a daily basis with heat protection, temperatures and gradients and what have you, these transient things, you know, many people cannot visualize heat.
Yeah, okay, I have trouble visualizing heat.
But if you expose yourself a lot, you know, then you get a sixth sense. You see immediately, if you see the material in the situation, you see how these isotherms flow, or where is the most important point and so forth. You know, you can develop the same as in descriptive geometry, you can develop your third dimension. Is that so? Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with descriptive geometry?
Not
probably
really,
not.
But I'm familiar
you?
With
Who
your concept you? Of sixth sense, yes.
Yeah, sixth
okay.
sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people, in the, I know them, they can visualize as the third dimension. There's no difficulty. They look at a drawing, and they can tell you in a few seconds, oh, this is that interferes with this one here. They have the sense that you can develop it. Mm-hmm. And the same is true, of course, with other things. That is, heat is not no exception. It all, what it requires is your exposure. Your exposure. You cannot draw interest from the bank without putting money in it. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to put in money. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it means a lot of time, hard work, sweat, and so forth. And so we had this excellent training in reentry, and then here came the problem of the reentry protection. And we solved this without any wind tunnel programs, which cost millions of dollars and run for years. We just used our past experience from the reentry nose cone protection and applied to the base heat protection of the first Saturn cluster. And it worked, and it worked. Was done by two men. And here we needed, of course, also extensively our computers, but by this time we had already a much better organization. And the computer had come into much, much more general use, you know. Some of our colleagues, they were afraid to go to a computer and use it. They had, certain...
Who were the two people who were working with you on this?
It was Charlie Wood, my deputy, mm-hmm. and Charlie Wood, and who was the other man? Was it Harvey Cornell, or was it, I guess it was Harvey Cornell.
Connell?
No,
Cornell. I'm sorry.
Harvey Cornell. But Charlie Wood did most of,
mm-hmm.
and their boss was at this time Dr. Head, Robert Head.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know came the orbital restart of the J2 engine, and this again required a lot of analysis and. A fairly young fellow, Frank Swan, he came up with a very ingenious computer program for analyzing orbital heating and temperatures and so forth.
Mm.
He's still here. He's now in CEC, but at this time he was in my organization. And this method was, because of its general nature, it was at that time it was used by many companies in the nation. And this allowed us to analyze the third stage. Now you must excuse if I jump from one thing to another.
No.
But I'm my red line is now thermal engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the contractor had proposed to use intermittent venting. You know, in the S4B, in orbit, in zero gravity, it was, of course, again a new field where little was understood and available. And I felt to dump 4,000 pounds of liquid hydrogen is a crime, you know, an engineering crime. You do not lift it up to this altitude in order to dump it. And we felt that we could, by the continuous vent scheme, which was then later on, after heavy fights, which was introduced, we could save 4,000 pounds of payload. 4,000 pounds of payload. But, you know, if you propose something, you do not gain anything. You risk only your head and your reputation. But before you come up with such a proposal, you have to be on firm ground. And to be on firm ground, we had to go through all these thermal analyses, you know. Then the internal tank dynamics, which I mentioned before, which
mm-hmm.
Professor John Clark, helped us a great deal starting in 54. And then Frank Swally made a valuable contribution. He had some kind of a vector method, which allowed very elegantly to calculate all the heat inputs and the heat losses in orbit, you know. And based on our analysis, we were very confident that this could be handled and could be done. And so we introduced the continuous vent scheme, much against the opposition of the stage contractor. And this had another beneficial effect at this time. These
Douglas was the contractor you're talking here?
Yeah, but we don't have to give any name. You know, I do not want to throw any mud or point a finger at anyone. Everyone makes mistakes or is headed in one time or another in the wrong direction. This is not important.
Mm-hmm.
Important is only to see how difficult it is sometimes to find the right way. Or it depends very much on individual people to come up with an improvement, you know, because no one can dictate this to you.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows the situation? The situation is only known by a few guys who work hard and analyze all this stuff and come up with a better concept. That is the reason why I do not want to mention any names. And probably under the pressure and at the time pressure, they had a good reason to be the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
But £4,000, I could not reconcile. So I asked Gordon Platt and Frank Smalley to look into this and see whether we couldn't. You want the names?
No, I've got Frank Smalley.
Frank Smalley. SWALLEY.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And Gordon Platt. Both very competent engineers. And of course, the results confirmed our